Welcome to a special episode of Berlin Stories. I'm Cricket Arison.
And I'm Dina Vollmer.
You're listening to The Barcade Song by Heiko Gabriel, like a musician who grew up in East Frisia and moved to Berlin in 2001. He wrote this song in the summer of 2005, while on a sort of musical pilgrimage to New York City. Heiko and three German friends had gone there to find musicians who were part of a scene called Antifolk. The scene was gaining recognition in Germany. A prominent intellectual had just published a popular book about antifolk. In February, a singer who had gotten his start in the antifolk scene graced the cover of German Rolling Stone. But in New York, Heiko and friends found the musicians playing at small clubs, mostly for each other. There wasn't much of a fan base, and there was even less favorable press coverage. That didn't stop Heiko from finding the energy there inspiring.
It was magic. I never experienced something like that after. It just came and came, and I wanted to write more songs. I don't know how many I wrote, like 5, I think, in 2 weeks. That's not too bad. The whole scene inspiring me, the people I met in New York, I felt that I want to be part of it.
Here's a recording of the Barcade song made in Central Park on a Sony cassette during that 2005 trip. Join us today as we explore why Germany embraced the obscure New York anti-folk scene. So what is anti-folk? As it turns out, there's not a simple answer to that question. Anti-folk is not a genre as much as it is a community centering around the sidewalk cafe in New York. And it has nothing to do with hating folk music. Here are some examples of music from the scene by Joey Dead Blonde Girlfriend, Moldy Peaches, Diane Cluck, and Pre-War Yard Sale.
I'm tired of fighting, I'm tired of losing. I give it all to you, I don't know what I'm doing. They tell me I gotta burn my body down. I said, man, oh man, I'm out of town.
Let's go sailing.
Let's go sailing.
Let's get a bite to eat.
Let's get a bite to eat.
Let's talk about movies.
Let's talk about movies.
Let's go to sleep.
Someone said to die daily, die daily implies be born daily up in my head.
Concentrated concrete cement bends and bonds while breaking contact.
We asked some German and American anti-folk musicians and experts to define what the term means. Here's what they said.
It's folk music, it's just not terribly good folk music.
The origin of anti-folk, as it was told to me years ago, is that a young latch, fresh out of college, moved to the West Village in the early 80s, and he started to attend the open mics there and found that the music was a really watered-down version of Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and the folk that had come before in the 60s, and now clubs in the West Village had co-opted this music and kind of turned it into a tourist attraction. So Latch and a few like-minded friends left the West Village disgruntled and moved east and started their own movement, essentially saying, if that's what you call folk, well, I guess we are anti-folk.
The artist Preston Spurlock, he made this t-shirt that says anti-folk, and it's a Bob Dylan's head, but his face is turned around, like upside down. It's probably like folk music with a weird aspect in it.
There's something that feels dumb about it, but also like totally genuine. People are confused by it, and they're like, what is it? It's like this thing that like people don't really want to like necessarily associate with, or they don't know how to deal with it. And I think it's because of that, because it isn't super well defined. It is about kind of like, well, whoever's here right now is going to do what they want to do, like, and they're just going to open themselves up and like express themselves like in the weirdest, most accurate way that they can. And that has allowed it to change a lot. It used to be really punk, and then kind of Moldy Peaches came through, and there's been a wave of like kind of goofy or silly acts, and now we're kind of in this place of like almost more like kind of like almost more folk revival or like Americana.
I think people in Germany use the word anti-folk to describe lots of different things. And I think that's largely due to journalists just copying off other journalists. I think, you know, once somebody like Martin Bisser or other reviewers wrote about the anti-folk scene in German magazines like Intro or Specs, other journalists did not really know that they maybe just meant like a small scene in New York that was more bound by geography than by style or genre. And they just used the term to describe any kind of rootsy, folksy music that was kind of quirky and cool or had some like aura of like authenticity.
That's Sebastian Hoffman, known to his friends as Sibzi, and one of the Germans who went to New York in search of anti-folk with Heiko in 2005. He has since become one of the biggest bookers of anti-folk shows in Europe, and he also recently completed his master's thesis about the anti-folk scene in New York. Here's Sibzi talking a little bit more about what anti-folk is.
First of all, I think anti-folk still largely borrows from a tradition of American folk music going back to the 1920s and 1930s, Woody Guthrie, This Machine Kills Fascists. There's like this just enormous anti-fascist connotation that American folk music has. On the other hand, that most of the lyrical content is not, of course, is not decidedly anti-fascist. I mean, the anti-folk is not about protest songs. But I think there's also this other question, like, what is a protest song in the 21st century? What can it be in a way? For me, protesting is not really done via content anymore, via lyrics, but more about how you deal with the works of production in a way, like how you distribute the music, in which ways you perform. So, and I think just by doing it differently than the music business, in some way you can already kind of, you know, deliver a message that cannot really be done via the lyrics anymore. And I think lyrically the anti-folk scene does something very postmodern in a way, because it realized that direct protest songs don't really work anymore. They're just usually seen as cheesy or too idealistic in a way. But I think what's really interesting about the anti-folk scene is that they really reflect on themselves as writers or as characters in their own songs. And I don't know if that's anti-fascist, but it's definitely postmodern, you know. It kind of deletes any kind of aggressiveness or machoist sentiment in the music. I had never really heard music that questioned itself. I mean, it was always like, maybe like, I grew up listening to, first of all, Eurodance, which is very unquestioning of itself, but also, I mean, in retrospect, quite honest about it. But then I listened to a lot of like Britpop music, like Oasis or Blur, and they were all very assertive of their own position as lyricists or writers. They didn't really question that. And then when I first heard anti-folk songs, it really blew my mind, because those people were maybe as unsure of themselves as I was when I listened to the music. And I think this is why I really got hooked on it in a way. And I think this is also one of the main reasons why it's not successful, because it just doesn't really fit into this whole like hip, cool, retromania thing.
That's Lance Romance's song, Mrs. Doubtfire's Boogie Bop Hop Shop Chop Drop. We tracked down some New York musicians to ask them about their early days in the anti-folk scene. Here's songwriter Phoebe Kreutz, a New York City native who has toured extensively in Germany and Europe.
I went to Sidewalk Cafe for the first time in maybe 2002 and was just sort of immediately embraced by Latch, who was running the whole show at that time. And I think it was a place where it felt like you could just sort of throw up some ideas and people would be more excited about the fact that you were trying something silly than if you were excellent at it. It seemed like there was sort of a jokey, folky vibe in the air in those days, especially where it was a lot of, you know, sort of playing guitar and then sort of making little jokey rhymes. And that's sort of the stuff that I was already interested in and what I grew up liking. So it just seemed like, ah, okay, great, this is the place for that.
We asked musician Toby Goodshank, former member of the popular anti-folk band The Moldy Peaches, about his early days at Sidewalk.
And the place was dingy and covered with show flyers and looked like a punk rock club. It was really cool. You know, that place is like a back room at a restaurant. So it's you know, we were playing at a restaurant basically all the time. Outside of like people hanging out there all the time, which I guess constitutes a scene, it didn't really feel like a musical movement per se, because even though it was like largely acoustic guitar based, I felt like stylistically performers were so different that I didn't really like fully understand what unified everyone, I guess. But it was an exciting time. I just saw a lot of performers that seemed like they were kind of like really going out on a limb to express themselves, and it inspired me to want to do something that was like my own and very unique and try to like be a better me.
Here's Neil Kelly, another New York City native and founding member of the shambolic party band Hug a Broomstick.
Sidewalk had like a scene. Like, I don't do it anymore, but for a while I would just show up there on any random day, like not knowing who was playing, and just see whatever, because it was just like, you knew if you went there, whoever was playing was like kind of part of that scene, that anti-folk thing, so it'd at least be interesting to watch.
By default, you know, because we had been playing at the anti-folk open mic at Sidewalk Cafe, you know, we're anti-folk. Like, it was kind of funny to reappropriate it for being about us, because the term felt more like something that was associated with like 1980s punk folk scene. But we were still participating in it, and in a lot of ways it was kind of becoming like our own vital music community. And it was just called by this name. So instead of, you know, I think most people shirk away from labels, but we thought it would be funny to like counterintuitively embrace perhaps like an incorrect label to reappropriate it for our own thing. And so we did it. We pushed anti-folk really hard, like, as, you know, as us and our friends. You know, me and Kimya put together a compilation of our friends, anti-folk people, for Rough Trade Records, and kept on repeating the word in press interviews. And it eventually got revitalized, the word, which is cool, you know, because the actual group of people is so impressive. The currency at the open mic was largely songwriting. And so a lot of people kind of raised the bar for each other to compete with each other and, you know, try to make, you know, better and better songs. Every small town has a little group of people like that, you know, and it's just that New York City's group became exposed more. But I think that every town has people like that, and there's kind of good music everywhere that you look if you go to the right place.
That was Adam Green, who fronted the band The Moldy Peaches with Kimya Dawson. This is his song, Mozzarella Swastikas. Adam also happens to be the musician we mentioned who was on the cover of German Rolling Stone. We'll hear more about that and about the development of anti-folk in Germany when we come back from this short break.
Now the king was reading comics when he stepped into some vomit, and he screamed like 40 wolves being burned.
Let's go.
Hi, this is Bob Boylan, host of NPR's All Songs Considered, here to remind you to view the entire archive of our Tiny Desk concerts at nprmusic.org.
All right, okay, all right, okay, all right, okay, all right, okay, now, return to the mat, what it is, what it does, what it is, what it isn't, looking for a better way to get up out of bed instead of getting on the internet and checking a new hit.
Freaked out. We are the
Welcome back to Berlin Stories. That was Truth Jump Fall by Toby Goodshank. Today we're talking about Antifolk, a music scene that started in New York and achieved greater recognition in Berlin and Germany than it ever did at home. As Moldy Peach's co-founder Adam Green said,
Antifolk largely is something that, you know, did well in New York City, and other than that, Europe liked it. There's no fans back home for Antifolk.
Adam's career is probably the best example of the broader story of Antifolk. His band, the Moldy Peaches, is one of the best-known Antifolk acts in the U.S., but they still weren't what you'd call famous. Their song, Anyone Else But You, might be familiar to you. It was performed by Michael Cera and Ellen Page in the movie Juno.
You're a part-time lover and a full-time friend. The monkey on your back is the latest trend. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone else but
you. I'll kiss you on the brain in the shadow of the train. Kiss you all starry-eyed, my body swinging from side to side. I don't see what anyone can see in anyone
else. Juno came out 5 years after the band broke up. In the meantime, Adam's crooning pop solo career had taken off in Germany, and he was famous, arena famous, cover of Rolling Stone famous. Here's Moritz Schädler, a concert promoter and musician from Liechtenstein, talking about hearing Adam's music everywhere.
I remember while working at McDonald's, Liechtenstein has one radio station, which is called Radio Liechtenstein. Emily became like this really big radio hit. Emily, I think, suited this radio quality, easy pop song kind of measure. So I remember making, building up burgers and cleaning toilets and hearing Emily.
Emily, sweet baby, won't you be my wife? Could ain't be wide open with a kitchen knife. Everybody said that she is underage. Honky tried to shoot me with a 7-gauge.
Adam was recently in Berlin on tour with his new project, Adam Green and Binky Shapiro. He sat down with his former bandmate, Toby Goodshank, to talk about his career in Germany and why he thinks he got so big here.
Before Moldy Peaches came here, what was your connection to Germany?
I had part of my family that was from Germany. There was sort of a famous love affair that my great-grandmother had had with the writer Franz Kafka, and the collapse of it had resulted in the inspiration for The Trial. So I guess I felt a connection to Berlin. I wanted to come here, but I didn't expect to be coming here so often. I think the first time that I came here was with the Moldy Peaches to play Club Knack. And we played Hamburg too. I feel like the Moldy Peaches kind of broke up in Germany. I think when the promoter came in asking for another German tour from the Moldy Peaches, and I remember being kind of hysterical, being like, I don't even know if I want to go on this tour.
Yeah. It was a long time. You guys have been playing those songs for a long time.
And you know, and I feel like even so, at that point, with the Moldy Peaches doing the German tour, there wasn't any sign that Germany was especially interested in anti-folk music or anything.
Then when your solo album started to catch on in Germany, do you remember when that first started happening?
Well, I was, after I recorded Friends of Mine, it became album of the month in the German Rolling Stone. So I had an indication that it was getting good reviews, and maybe better reviews than in other countries.
Any thoughts as to why your music was being so well received here?
The real answer is that I don't know. But I think that factors contributing to it are that I was perhaps in the right place at the right time. I was sort of able to fulfill some, you know, need that people had for someone to like come along and be sort of like a folk singer, you know, and that I was personally, you know, coming into my own as a songwriter at the time. So, you know, I think I was like, you know, giving off like a very like kind of positive, creative, you know, vibe. You know, I did a lot of interviews with like highbrow press, like Der Spiegel, or like weird things that, you know, most musicians don't do. You know, I put out a book with Zurkamp Verlag with like poetry and, it felt like, you know, like, it was my own version of being everywhere, and it just grew and grew, as a sort of idea, you know, that I was some kind of like a German pop star, you know. When Gemstones came out, by the time that came out, it was like a top 10 album. And I was doing all the spots on like all the big TV shows, which is funny because we're going to do the TV Total show tomorrow, which is cool. They didn't have me on the show for a while after the Sixes and Sevens interview.
the infamous drunken romp.
Yeah, right. And it was sitting on the host's lap.
Here's a clip from that TV Total interview.
Is it just an image you create, or is it, are you a little, strange?
I'm just the kind of guy that wants to sit on your lap.
Okay. Ah, wunderbar.
How has your career in Germany differed from elsewhere?
In Germany, well, I don't really know. It's kind of like at first it was so like lopsided and disproportionate in Germany. Like I had like all my fans are in Germany or something. And, didn't end up being the case forever. Now I feel like it's sort of evened out. Like I can't really tell if a show is in Germany or not by like the size of the audience or anything. But I do think that in a funny way, the genuine thing about Germany was there was that for reals backlash that I felt.
At what point?
Oh, around Sixes and Sevens. You know, I guess there was some kind of anticipation for you know, me to do something that was like, you know, maybe not really like what I'm supposed to be doing. So, you know, I think that people, you know, kind of gave my albums pretty harsh criticism and, you know, maybe like, you know, kind of just like cast me off a bit, in Germany while the rest of the world would, you know, just didn't have, that relationship with me, and they didn't have to look at my career as being ever so high that they needed to be, like,
right, there's like no trajectory.
Yeah, like so in, you know, in France and Spain and Italy, like, you know, every successive album I did, you know, was increased my popularity, you know, whereas in Germany, like, my popularity was like peaked at Gemstones or Jacket Full of Danger, you know, and then for a period I was like a fallen star. Only in Germany, which was strange. It's been funny to experience like the celebrity in like a microcosm like that.
Did you have any reservations about coming here initially, being Jewish?
No, not really. I mean, I do feel like in a way, I think because of my own cheeky nature, projected myself to Germans as a Jewish person, you know, by heritage. And I think I was treated as a Jewish person culturally. You know, I do think that, like, in a way that, like, the welcoming of me was, in a way, like, symbolic of the returning of some of the culture that had left Germany in World War II, you know, as did my family. And, like, the return and celebration of somebody like me was symbolic of some kind of, like, reconnection with that idea. And so I believe that it will endure throughout my life in a weird way. That Germany will behave differently than other countries towards me and possibly, you know, will end up becoming the most important country for me as an artist when I'm an old person. I don't know.
Did you ever get an inkling that Germans found your music particularly political?
I mean, I think that people thought of it as anti-authority because, you know, like the punk aesthetic was like very pervasive in everything that I was doing. And, like a lot of like my views about things were kind of nihilistic. And I mean, you know, if anything, you know, I kind of was hating the government. So
while Adam Green is the best known German American anti-folk crossover artist, many other New York anti-folk artists used to small crowds at home were surprised to find that there was an audience for their music in Germany. Here's songwriter and guitar player Dibson T. Hofweiler, who toured Germany for the first time in 2006 with Hug a Broomstick.
It just sounded like a pipe dream. When shows started getting booked, like I remember, Sibsy booked that whole tour for us, and I just kind of remember almost being like scared at that point, being like, oh, like I didn't really think this would happen. It just seemed too unreal.
What was your impression of being in Germany for the first time?
And I think I got in and played a show that first night. That was such a shock just to see a bunch of people there because I didn't have any connection to Germany, really. So to be playing at a bar and have a bunch of people there to see Hug a Broomstick and the Wows was kind of like, why are these people here? And it was totally delightful. I mean, it kind of made us all feel like we were like rock stars a little bit more, because I feel like we've played so many shows in New York where like often no one would show up. And then all of a sudden, again, we're in a foreign country, like with all these people we don't know, like who there's more of a communication barrier, yet they seem more enthusiastic and they're more excited and they're more interested about what we're doing. In New York, anti-folk is kind of not illegitimate, but just it doesn't feel like it's that respected. Or if it's ever mentioned in the press, it's always kind of like, yeah, those anti-folk guys, like whatever that means. As a music scene, it's kind of like the ugly stepchild or something, or like the ugly duckling that like no one really wants to respect. And I think that first trip to Germany, I didn't necessarily get a sense that it was celebrated there, but I felt like we had more legitimacy. Recalling like this show and like Martin Busser being there and just people being like, oh, that guy wrote a book about anti-folk. And I was just like, really? I feel like the Germans understand the culture of it more, where they're like, oh, like this is not about like how it sounds, but it's about, you know, making music that has like certain philosophical values or personal values.
Neil Kelly, who also toured Germany with Hug a Broomstick in 2006, told us that German audiences were eager to learn more about his music.
I don't know. They were always like, what does this mean? Or like, what are you trying to do? And it was like, we're always like, we're trying to be in a band and we're trying to play music. Like, they're expecting us to have some kind of like ulterior motive. It was always just like, no, it really is just a song about pooping in a bag and setting it on fire. That's really all that it's about. Little brown ball of ash, pick 'em off the street and brown bag it. Set it on fire and sit
behind your neighbor's bushes, watch 'em step on. Here's Phoebe Kreutz on Coming to Berlin.
Berlin, it seems like it's changing really rapidly, but when I first got there, and that would have been maybe 2005, it felt like the New York of my childhood. Like, it had that kind of feeling of anarchy. It just felt like, oh, you can kind of do whatever you want here. You can drink a beer on the subway. There's graffiti. There's silliness. There's people just lounging around. And I don't know, it just felt very homey. And it's nothing that I would have expected because, you know, growing up in America, you sort of, all you see of German is sort of, it's like the stereotypes of sort of like this uptight kind of Sprockets-y guy who's kind of unfriendly and like super pretentious and artistic, and that's sort of what you think the German music fans are going to be. But I really felt like there is some serious goofballs in Germany, which I would never have thought of. Just a real openness and kind of, you know, silliness of spirit that I don't encounter so many in a lot of other European countries.
And at that time, did you sense an kind of an interest and enthusiasm for what was called anti-folk music?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there's such great music that's being made over there, and so it's nice to have the little cross-pollination. We'd already experienced it a little bit with when Sibzi and Heiko were both, you know, interested in music, and Christina and Charlotta, and they all came and they had a sort of, you know, I mean, I guess saying a fan energy sort of makes it sound not as equal as it was, but they came with a lot of enthusiasm. And it was exciting for us to think that there were people in another continent who actually were into what we were doing and already knew some of the songs. It was exciting to think that there was a place where we could go and feel like musicians, to feel like, you know, people who were writing songs, and it was actually mattering to people besides just, you know, our parents.
I haven't looked in the mirror for days. I don't care if my hair is messy. I keep on wearing the same pair of jeans. Don't wanna get dressed up.
Phoebe Kreutz's song, Grown Ups. At the same time that Americans were coming over to Germany, there were local efforts by Germans to foster the scene and play their own anti-folk inspired music.
Shampoo and cornflakes, juice and rubber snakes, fish and alcohol, you can have it all.
you can pay. You just have to drive to the nearest hypermarché. Socks and soda pops.
We caught up with Boohoo, a Frankfurt-based songwriter, in a hotel lobby in Chemnitz while he was on tour. So pardon the background noise.
I had been a fan of Adam Green from the moment probably I saw him with the Moldy Peaches on German music television. I've never been such a huge fan of the Moldy Peaches, but when his solo stuff came out, it was pretty honest. It sounded pretty poorly recorded. The quality of his recordings that encouraged me to buy a 4-track thing and to start recording myself, because his record was an actual record in my hands, but from what I heard it was nothing more than a home recording. And I thought, wow, if he can do it and his stuff ends up at my record dealer's shop somehow, I can do probably something too.
In Berlin, German anti-folk fans took it upon themselves to produce and promote the scene. A monthly series called 4-Track on Stage highlighted local and touring anti-folk acts, while Heiko started an open mic named the Open Michael J. Fox that was based on the Sidewalk Cafe Anti-Hoot in New York. You're listening to 4-Track Boy by D. Cooper.
Style, waiting for some money, waiting for a smile. He's a 4-track boy, releasing style. Waiting for some money, waiting for a smile. He's got nothing else to do but hanging around.
We sat down with Heiko and Sibzi to talk about their scene building efforts in Berlin.
I'm one of the organizers of 4-Track on Stage, and I'm also hosting the open mic since a couple of years.
I got totally influenced by the way Ledge was doing it in New York. I think I started it 5 years ago in 2008. Maybe the intention was to create some sort of a scene like it happened in New York, because I think the open mic that Ledge did, just making a frame for artists, musicians to meet, is automatically bringing the people together and yeah, they connect to each other, organize shows together, play with each other, join in on their musical projects and stuff.
But I think the main difference between the Latches open mic in New York and the one that you do in Berlin, Heiko, is that there is actually an audience in Berlin, whereas I think in New York it's mostly just performers waiting for their turn. Because I feel like with the first time I went to the open mic in New York, I really think I was the only member of the audience that was actually only there for watching.
Yeah, actually, I would like if everyone at the open mic in Berlin, like at the open Michael J. Fox, is. I don't like the audience that much. There's a gap between the people who just listen and the people who perform, and I always wonder why the people who are coming for watching are not just starting out making their own kind of music.
But
you know?
I mean, maybe lots of them already did.
Some did. Yeah. Yeah, some come watching and then they start. I like that a lot.
I think it doesn't really bother me, because otherwise I feel like the also like this whole touring thing of anti-folk musicians in Germany would not work, you know, because you just need an audience. There has to be some crowd.
It's not bothering me that there's people watching the show. It's bothering me that the people are being just consumers and feel like it's like here we are now, entertain us, you know.
Yeah, but I think there's like this nice like ethnomusicological term called the extra musicians, which basically means that most like DIY shows incorporate an audience that is always in some way related to the performance, not only performing, but for example also doing the sound, doing the door, doing the flyers, you know. And I think that's definitely true, like in the 4-Track on Stage scene in Berlin. In New York, it's apparent to such an extreme in a way. But I think in Berlin, it's also in a way there, you know. Americans in generally are just a lot better at performing their selves in a way, because they're taught to. And, you know, and I think in Germany, kind of performing your own identity is sometimes even looked down on, you know.
It's
a little bit more of a collectivist society.
And that's maybe the reason why so many Americans like the Germans. They don't, they have a problem with showing off a little bit.
Yeah, but I think on the other hand, I mean, if you turn this whole argument around, you know, I feel like the anti-folk scene is so open in a way that I think even the most reserved German feels like welcomed by it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, we would never even imagine being a performer or performing ourselves in a way, but in the context of the scene, we can do it and not be looked down on. The anti-folk scene kind of created like the safe space for failing in a way.
I like failure. I like if people fall down and stand up again. I like that.
That's very American of you.
You're listening to Berlin Stories, and this is I'm a Idiot by the Johns. We're Cricket Arison
and Dina Vollmer.
We'll be right back to talk more about why anti-folk music found a home in Germany, just after this short break.
NPR Music keeps you up with everything from rock and pop to jazz, classical, and beyond. Get lost in thousands of hours of interviews, recommendations, and exclusive live performances only at nprmusic.org.
What does one do to get a glass of water? Said the stranger.
Welcome back to Berlin Stories. You're listening to Berlin Song by André Hermann Dune. I'm Cricket Arison.
And I'm Dina Vollmer.
Today we're tracing how anti-folk, a small New York music scene, made its way over to Germany. So at this point, we know that anti-folk became a hit in Germany. But the big question remains, why? Here's what concert promoter and booking agent Sibsi Hoffman said.
Why did anti-folk have its 5 minutes of fame in Germany? I think it has three reasons. One is there was just interest from media and press. I think at that time, doing lo-fi rock music was quite unusual because nobody had really done it in a couple of years. So I think there's definitely this kind of, it's a new thing, we'll write about it. And then a few months later, something else is hip or exciting. And Jeffrey Lewis said that his record label at that time, Rough Trade in the UK, had a partnership with Sanctuary Records in Germany, who at the time just had a lot of employees and somehow had a budget for promoting his records. So there was a considerable amount of press for him. So I think that's like one reason number one. That's more like this kind of industry, music industry level.
Rough Trade is the only major record label to release anti-folk, if only for a few years in the early 2000s. The label also put out the Moldy Peaches album, the first solo records of Adam Green and Kimya Dawson, and the compilation Adam and Kimya curated called Anti-Folk Volume 1. There was never a Volume 2. We talked to musician Jeffrey Lewis, who has toured extensively in Europe, about the music industry side of anti-folk.
Rough Trade did not have a presence in the U.S. Like, my album had not come out in the U.S. So whereas I started overseas, going over there for, like, the album release, and then realizing, like, wow, there's, like, these people that are into this. And there was, like, press, and there were, like, good reviews for the album that I could build off of. So even though it started very small, it was, like, a start that we could build on. Whereas in the U.S., the album never really got released.
Here's Jeffrey's song, Don't Let the Record Label Take You Out to Lunch.
Don't let the record label take you out to lunch. You're the one who's gotta pay at the end of the day. And try not to want people to like you too much. You'll just need more and more flatteries to recharge your batteries.
Here's Sibsy again on the second reason that anti-folk caught on in Germany.
I think the most interesting and kind of important reason maybe could be described as like the leftist German independent music scene, which also has... like a connected wing of publishing. I think the most prominent person is the late Martin Büsser, who also wrote a book on the anti-folk scene that came out a few years ago. And I think he was just really, really amazed and enthusiastic about the scene. And he and Martin Büsser established a small publishing house in Mainz with a couple of friends called Ventil Verlag, which publishes a small semi-academic journal called Test Card that comes out every few months. They had, in my opinion, a very important issue that really defined this circle's relationship with anti-folk. The issue was dedicated to America, to the United States and Canada, at a time when anything American was very unhip and unpopular in Germany and in most of Europe, because it was the time of the beginning of the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War started by George Bush. And at the same time, in the German pop world, by pop I mean like popular music or like indie music, also defended itself in a way with the help of the German government against American cultural influences. So at that time there were campaigns to get more German language music on the radio, and lots of German bands somehow wanted to establish a new positive German national identity. And Martin Büsser and lots of the people from the Ventil Verlag did not really like that approach, and they thought that it was really silly and despicable in a way. So they were looking for alternatives, on the one hand to somehow redeem America's image in the German pop world, and on the other hand also find examples of music scenes that did not have a strong focus on the nation or other more conservative values like the family and stuff like that. And I think this is really a major reason why Martin Büsser really liked the anti-folk scene, because on the one hand, the name even applies it. It is in a way an anti-nationalist scene, or could be read as one. I think Martin Büsser wrote that for him it's not only anti-puritanical folk music, but also could be read as anti-folk, written with a V. So Hitler's notion of the Volksgemeinschaft, this like stable notion of ethnically pure people. Like, I think it's not only related to like Hitler, Nazism. I think it's for Büsser and the Ventil Verlag. They didn't really look to the past, but they looked very much into the present by current neo-Nazi groups that also use Völkisch as like, you know, Völkisch imagery and stuff like that. And they didn't really, and their main fear was basically that, look, if we have like a very non-reflective nationalistic pop discourse now, then the bridge to neo-Nazi groups is not that far in a way. But what Martin Büsser really liked about the anti-folk scene was that in the songs of the anti-folk scene, there were no positive images of the nation or the family or heterosexual love, only in very few instances. Yeah, and I think that Büsser then kind of, since he also wrote for a little bit of a more mainstream magazine, Intro, which is widely distributed in Germany for free, a big music magazine, he also was able to write reviews and articles about the scene for a magazine that tens of thousands of young people in Germany read. And of course, like every independent promoter in Germany at that time, at least, read Intro. So they were, of course, interested. And when the first people came over from New York, they started just booking shows for them. And I think they just kept doing it, because I think they just became personal friends with the musicians.
When we talk to people about anti-folk music today, that last reason that Sibsy named, friendship, came up again and again. It's been 12 years since the Moldy Peaches album came out, and there's not much institutional support for anti-folk from labels anymore. And with America enjoying a better reputation in Germany since the end of the Bush years, left-wing intellectuals no longer champion anti-folk for ideological reasons. Here's Phoebe Kreutz and then Dibson Hofweiler talking about what holds the anti-folk community together today.
Yeah, there's sort of, I mean, it seems like there's just sort of that network that goes around Germany of friends, and then it gets expanding and expanding. And I think because nobody's getting rich off of it, everybody feels pretty generous with it, you know? And so people have been incredibly welcoming and just sort of, you know, that, oh, hey, I have a cousin who's got a boyfriend who used to run a bar. Maybe he still knows those people. Maybe he could hook you up with a show. And they do it. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of energy.
The relationship and the friendship aspect of it, it's like almost or even like more important than the music aspect of it. And I think that's another thing that makes it kind of like a dirty word, because there's this idea that like, well, if it's a music scene, it should be about the music. If a German came to the US and saw you and saw your band and they liked you, they shouldn't invite you because they want to be your friend. They should invite you because they love your music and they want to share your music with everybody.
On the German side, promoters from Hamburg to Hanover to Darmstadt to Nuremberg keep small anti-folk hubs going throughout Germany. Here's Sigmar Roscher, a promoter from the small town of Wetzlar.
The problem in Wetzlar is most people who go to concert are between 20 and 35. And these people are missing in Wetzlar. We have this small society who promotes these concerts. 15 people. We don't know how we can make this financial part. We can pay them and so. And so we said, okay, we collect money in front of the concert to guarantee the fee and the salary.
You collect money from the like tip jar? Or do you mean from each other?
From each other, yeah.
So you all put money in,
yeah,
so that you can make the guarantee?
Yeah, so we can pay the artist if nobody comes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Has it changed your life?
Definitely, yes.
How so?
Okay, less money. We have less money. And it's more interesting. It's more fun.
We asked Matthias Kalm from the Canadian band The Burning Hell, another group on Sibsy's roster, who is researching the four-track music scene for his musicology dissertation, to talk about how the community has changed over the years.
When I first got here in 2008, I was so blown away by how enthusiastic Sibsy and Heiko and Jan and Charlotte and all these other folks were about putting on shows. Like, they were so excited about shows. That enthusiasm was really infectious. And then every year, I have to be honest, like every year since then, I've noticed like enthusiasm waning for sure. But at the same time, I feel like it hasn't all been bad. I mean, there's been some really positive things too. Like, I mean, Sibsy's like kind of professionalized his old role in, you know, in the scene by now like being an actual official booking agent, working for an official booking agency and stuff like that. And he's still doing like the kind of stuff that he was doing a few years ago. It's just now it's like under a different name.
Here's Sibsy and Heiko talking about the business side of things.
Anti-folk's really anti-capitalistic in a way, yeah. And more about the warmness and the humanity.
But Sibsy, but now that you've professionalized it with your job,
yeah,
isn't that dependent on these artists succeeding in some way?
I think if you put it into general terms, what I do as a booking agent is still failing. Because no other booking agent who would do it professionally would first of all work with those artists. Because they don't have a business plan, they don't have a record label, they don't have distribution in Europe. So basically their chances of succeeding in the music world or music market are about zero. But I somehow still do it because I like the music and I think that should still have a platform in Europe. But I think if I wouldn't do it, then I don't know who else would do it because there's no money to be made.
No money to be made. Yeah, that's a good thing. That's our life.
And again, from Matthias Kalm.
When a musician decides that they're excited and happy about this kind of world of music where you're not playing to hundreds of people, you're playing to dozens of people, and you're making your records yourself, and you're making your videos yourself, and you're making your album art yourself, and you're connecting with other people who are also doing that sort of thing. And the goal isn't, you know, fame and fortune. The goal is to be happy producing music and playing music for other people. When you sort of take on that attitude, then it becomes, that attitude is very self-sustaining. You know, even if the four-track scene here dies, and, you know, Sipsy becomes a lawyer and Heiko becomes a whatever Heiko would become, and, you know, and that all goes away, you know, the ethos kind of behind that is, it exists and existed long before four track. What is important about music? Well, for me, writing a song is important, or like having a great show where you feel like you've actually made some kind of connection with someone in the audience, or like having fun recording an album rather than like making a great album or whatever. Like, that's nice too, but I've never done that. So realizing that the only point of playing music is to have a good time, for me anyway. And Berlin has definitely helped me come to that place.
Here's Phoebe Kreutz.
I don't know if things are going to get bigger. It's possible that for me, like, the level of show and the level of success that I enjoy in Germany might be, like, that might be about right for me. That might be about the tip top, because I am able to go and I can play these like beautiful little shows full of sweet people who I look forward to seeing, and I can, you know, support the trip, and we can make a little bit of money. And that might be about where I level off. There's that sort of capitalist idea, like, if you're not growing, you're dying. And that's possible, and it might be that I'm not going to keep doing this forever. Or, who knows, the skies will open and I'll be lifted up into a musical Valhalla I haven't dreamed of yet.
You've been listening to Berlin Stories. This is All Summer Long by Phoebe Kreutz. To hear her and some of the musicians we featured today, including Toby Goodshank, Dibs, and The Burning Hell, head to the 5th annual Down by the River Festival in Berlin on July 6th at about blank. More information on the Down by the River Festival Facebook page.
For a list of all the songs we played in the show today, and more information about Antifolk, visit berlinantifolk.tumblr.com. This program is dedicated to the memory of Dashan Corum and Martin Busser, without whom this story would not have been possible. I'm Dina Vollmer.
And I'm Cricket Arison.
And thanks for joining us.
Berlin Stories on NPR FM Berlin 104.1.